This is an ABC podcast.
Hello from Marlo and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the land of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. It's Friday, February 21. Happy end of the week to you all, and thanks for tuning in because we've got a big show coming up. We look at how Donald Trump's federal funding cuts could impact Micronesia, also calls to reintroduce the death penalty in PNG, and the Pacific Oz Netball Tournament tips off in Brisbane. All that and more coming up. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first, protections against drug trafficking and climate change could be removed in Micronesia as US President Donald Trump freezes and reshapes foreign aid spending into the region. In the Marshall Islands, Marjoro's sole FBI agent has been sent packing, potentially hampering drug and corruption investigations. Meanwhile, guaranteed funding for climate-related projects under the Compact of Free Association PACs might be redirected to other areas.
The global warming you have to worry about, not that the ocean's going to rise in 400 years an eighth of an inch and you'll have more seafront property, right, if that happens. I said, isn't that a good thing?
US President Donald Trump has made his stance on climate change very clear. As for what that means for US climate assistance in the Pacific, well, Palau President Sarangawipes Jr. says it's anyone's guess.
We understand there's differences and we've got to talk through them. And all we ask, I think, from President Trump is that at least he allows us the opportunity to share and try to come up with solutions. If we don't want to call it climate change, let's call it natural disasters. But we do have challenges and we need partnership. So,
Palau is one of three island states in the North Pacific that shares a special arrangement with the US, a Compact of Free Association Agreement. The agreement delivers the islands hundreds of millions in economic assistance and makes up 80% of all US foreign aid in the Pacific region. But despite this special arrangement, not even the COFA states have been spared from blanket foreign aid cuts under President Trump.
There's like a communication package, stuff on the hospital, other programs that are outside the COFA that have been halted for reviews. We're hoping that they get through it quickly so we can get back to work.
A pledge to extend the COFA agreements for the next 20 years was finalized by US Congress last year. In theory, it ensures $7 billion in economic support will be delivered to the three nations regardless of who's in the White House. But it might not be that simple under President Trump.
There's a couple of processes in there that people have to pay attention to.
That's Robert Underwood, a former politician who served as Guam's delegate to the US House of Representatives from 1993 to 2003. He's familiar with the complexities of how COFA funds are delivered.
Even though the money has been approved, they still have to go through a process where there are approval of sectoral grants, what they say, like in education or in health. And then that's subject to a committee. And that committee is now going to be composed of two members from the U.S. side, two members from the freely associated state side, and they're supposed to, you know, agree to these sectoral grants. Now, how the new administration proposes which sectoral grants and the nature of those sectoral grants could be affected tremendously by the perspective of the new administration. Even though they may not be able to stop the funding, they may be able to move the funding in ways which were not anticipated.
With that in mind, Mr. Underwood says projects that don't align with Trump's values, projects that protect against climate change, for instance, could be at risk of being redirected.
You have to revamp your language. So, you know, and this is now common in Washington, D.C., for programs across the board. Climate change is no longer approved kind of language to utilize in the new administration. You have to come up with other things like resilience or projects of that nature. So the dialogue, the terms of the dialogue, the terms of the conversation have shifted dramatically.
He says Guam, which also has a COFA agreement with the US, has several environmental and sustainable programs now under a cloud. But it's cuts to federal law enforcement which has other experts on edge. In amongst Trump's federal aid cuts was the withdrawal of an FBI presence in the Marshall Islands.
My thought was how short-sighted this decision was, not just the impact for the region, for the Pacific, but also from a US perspective.
Jose Sousa Santos is an associate professor of practice, convener and leader of the Pacific Regional Security Hub at the University of Canterbury. He says the lack of an FBI presence will make it much tougher for US law enforcement to understand what's happening in the region, as well as inform Pacific states of potential threats.
This leaves a hole, let's say, in the regional security architecture, which could possibly be filled by countries like China, and whose policing and law enforcement MOs are not the same as what the Pacific has built its security structures on. That becomes a disruptor to the architecture, specifically to the fact of the lack of interoperability between both systems. And currently the region does not need an extra complication to add to its woes in regards to transnational crime, trafficking and methamphetamines.
Jose Sousa Santos is an associate professor of practice, convener and leader of the Pacific Regional Security Hub, and he was ending that report there from myself. Well, multiple countries are on cyclone alert as strong weather systems form in the South Pacific. Schools have closed and some flights have been cancelled in Samoa amid reports of flooding and strong winds. Reports from the Bureau say a cyclone could form within the next 24 hours. And to find out more, I'm joined by meteorologist Neville Coop from Ngadraki Weather. Neville, thanks for joining us on the program.
Good morning, Carl.
So I guess just firstly, is a cyclone imminent and what countries could be affected?
Right. So we're entering a very busy period of weather right across the southwest Pacific, stretching from the Coral Sea close to far north Queensland all the way across to the Cook Islands. And in that region, we have about three or four significant what we call disturbance areas, which are clusters of convective clouds which have the potential to go on and become tropical cyclones. Now, one of those is located south of Samoa, just to the south of Pangapango this morning, about 400 or 500 kilometres. And being south, the centre being south of Samoa, Samoa is in the very moist, convergent northwesterly airstream on the north side of that system, and hence the heavy rain and flooding. That system is very likely to become a cyclone later today, I would think. All of the computer forecasts are suggesting it will. And it will move south, southeast initially, then south and pass just to the west of Niue, probably tonight or early tomorrow morning. And it will be a significant cyclone, Category 2, perhaps a weak Category 3 system. Fortunately, it's going to pass to the east of Niue, so the most of the wind and the heaviest of the rain is on the east side of the centre. So it's on the side. So Niue will be in the side that's least affected by the very strong winds and heavy rain. So it'll still be pretty nasty, but I think they've come out of it fairly reasonably in the long term. There are more systems on the horizon, though.
I see. Yeah, well, let's talk about those more systems on the horizon. I understand Fiji might be impacted later down the track. Is that right?
Yes, it's looking more and more likely. There is a one of these disturbed areas of weather just to the north of us, just to the south of Rotuma. And that system is starting to appear in the satellite imagery this morning as a cluster of convective clouds that are pretty disorganized at the moment. But if you believe the computer models, and they're behaving pretty well at the moment, that system will deepen and gather more organisation in its cloud over the next 24 to 36 hours, probably becoming a strong depression or perhaps even a weak cyclone by Saturday morning, at which point it will likely be over the western region of the Wallace and Futuna group to our north. And where it goes from there is a little uncertain at this stage, but in all likelihood, it will directly affect some parts of Fiji. We just don't know precisely where and precisely when. And we certainly don't yet know precisely how intense it will be. It's still in the very embryonic stage, so we'll have to watch it and see over the next day or so as it evolves and the threat will become clearer. But we do expect that Fiji Met Service will begin to provide some warnings on this system before very long.
I see. Well, we'll definitely stay tuned to that to see what the updates are. Neville, it's been, a relatively quiet cyclone season up until now, but it seems like we could have two active cyclones taking place at the same time. Is that fair to say?
Yes. In fact, depending on how long they last and how they go, there may be a third. There's another one in the Western Coral Sea, closer to Queensland. There's a system they're monitoring to the south of Port Moresby at the moment in the Coral Sea. That system has the potential to intensify. In fact, that one, by all accounts from the computer forecast, looks like it might be the most intense one. Could be a Category 4 or so, and it will likely move on a southeast path, taking it between New Caledonia and the sort of central southern Queensland coast, that sort of part of the world, later in early parts of next week. But at this stage, that system is less, even more uncertain than the one we've got to the north of Fiji. So we have the one near Samoa, which is pretty much happening now, the one near Fiji, which will probably become a system of interest tomorrow, and then this one, which will probably start to become an issue later in the weekend ahead.
And just recapping, the one that is most imminent at the moment, currently above Samoa, we can expect that to form sometime today into a cyclone. Niue will be the most impacted, but it won't take a direct hit. Is that right?
That's how I see it at this stage. We'll have to wait and see. There are no actual warnings out for this system yet. I just checked again online, and we're just waiting for Fiji Met to come good. It's certainly, by my through my experience, looks like it's already reached sort of marginal tropical cyclone strength. It's an anomaly of the naming system. The way these things are named, it requires that winds above gale force completely surround the center all the way around. But at the moment, there are certainly gales about the north, east, and southeast around to south, but the western side of the circulation, the winds haven't yet reached gale force. So strictly speaking, by all accounts, it's not a tropical cyclone, but certainly there are gales associated with it already, and it's just how quickly those gales spread throughout before they actually give it a name.
I see. Well, we'll definitely be watching very closely to see how it all unfolds. Neville, thank you very much for that update, and thanks for joining us on Pacific Beat.
You're welcome, Kyle.
That was Neville Coop from Ndraki Weather speaking with us there. Three cyclones potentially forming in the Pacific, so a very much batten down the hatches kind of situation.
Pacific Beat.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat, where we are going to head to the high seas now to talk some tuna, because when it comes to government revenue in the Pacific, tuna is a major revenue earner for PNG, Kiribati, Marshall Islands, Solomon Islands, Palau, Tuvalu, and the Federated States of Micronesia. These countries account for a third of the world's tuna supply, but their market share could be at risk in coming decades due to the effects of climate change and warming ocean. But a new grant from the Green Climate Fund, worth more than $100 million, with co-financing worth around $57 million, will help Conservation International and the Pacific community better understand the threat to tuna stocks posed by climate change. Joining us this morning from Noumea is Dr. Graham Pilling, Deputy Director of the Oceanic Fisheries Program at the Pacific Community. Good morning, Dr. Pilling.
Good morning. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about this.
No, not a problem at all. Now, this is an area you've been studying. What do we know about the impact of climate change on tuna stocks?
The work that we've been doing with our partners has looked at what the potential pathways are in terms of the impacts on tuna. And there's an increasing risk as climate change impacts the ocean and warms the ocean waters that tuna are going to move further east in the Pacific. And that means that they're more likely to move outside the zones of our Pacific Island members and onto the high seas. So as you say, that really impacts the potential revenues that members can gain from that important tuna fishery.
Yeah, wow. So what does that mean for countries earning their revenue from tuna fishing? Like what's the dollar value of their loss?
Well, if you think about some key countries, you're talking about a third of their government revenue, so millions and millions of dollars that they're gaining from the tuna fishery. And we're talking about a 10 to 20% reduction in that revenue by around 2050 on average.
Yeah, wow, so quite a lot. Well, let's get to your research and how that will help Pacific countries. Will this help supplement their stock?
What the grant is going to do over the next 7 years is build on the work that New Zealand has kindly been funding to get the region into the position where it can hit the ground running when this grant comes out. And there's two strands to the grant. There is the mitigating the impact on coastal fisheries, where we know that climate change will have impacts on coral reef. And what it is trying to do is set up fish aggregating devices, which aggregate tuna in particular in nearshore waters that will allow coastal communities to access that resource to mitigate the impacts of climate change on the coastal fisheries. And on the oceanic side, we're developing an early warning system, as we term it, which is going to improve our understanding of the way climate is impacting on our tuna resources and give much better and more precise information to our members in terms of what those impacts are, what kind of pathways we're moving along, and therefore they can make much better decisions to mitigate the impacts and plan in advance for those outcomes.
Yeah, really interesting. And I understand this is the first time that money has been granted for research, I guess, rather than management. Is that right?
It is. I mean, it is a technical grant. It's the largest finance that we've been able to access from the commitments that were promised under the Global Climate Agreements. And it's really welcome to receive it. But it's taken more than 6 years to get here. And this is why the New Zealand grant to get us into the right position was really important. So really, the access to those funds is coming too slowly for the countries that are really in the front line of the impacts of climate change.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with Dr. Graham Pilling, Deputy Director of the Oceanic Fisheries Program at the Pacific Community, about a grant to better understand the threat climate change poses to tuna stocks. Now, I want to sort of circle back to what you were saying earlier about tuna migrating east. There's not a lot that Pacific countries can do to bring them back, from what I understand. Does that mean that, I guess, that element of it is a bit of a lost cause?
Not really. If we can understand what the patterns are likely to be, and then we can work with our partners like the Foreign Fisheries Agency and CSIRO, as well as Conservation International, who's the accredited agency, to put them in a good position to start negotiating and, ensuring that their current resources are recognized, even if they move out of their zones because of climate change. So it's a kind of climate justice issue.
Yeah, I see. And in terms of food security, so do Pacific communities, like how much do they rely on tuna for their food source? I mean, what's that impact of this migration?
It varies a lot country to country. And I think the thing that this grant is trying to do is set members up to better access the tuna that are in their waters for the coastal communities. Because the challenge is tuna are offshore. You have to go a long way in your boat to access those fish. And it's an awful lot of effort to do so. And they're much more set up for the kind of coastal coral reef fisheries. So if we can improve the access to that and improve that, the safety of that access, which is also part of this project, they can have an alternative source of food that balances out the impacts on the coral reef fisheries.
Yeah, because I also read as well that in amongst this, also shrinking was species of fish closer to the coast due to coral bleaching as well. Is that right?
That's right. And one of the other approaches that we're taking is that where tuna vessels that have been fishing offshore, industrial vessels are fishing offshore, come in, the community also has the access to the bycatch species that are being caught. So the non-target species could then be sold in the local market to support the food security issue.
Yeah, I see. And just finally, Mr. Pilling, so it sounds like, I guess, the real crux of this project is just you're going to have a lot more accurate and reliable data. I guess before, you know, this grant and projects like this came along, sort of what kind of challenges were they facing?
In terms of access to data and
yeah, that's right. I guess knowing which way the fish are migrating and things like that, and knowing where to fish and stuff like that.
Exactly. It's a massive fishery and it's a massive region. And collecting that information across our region is something that has been going on for a number of years. But this particular issue requires a different set of data, a different source of information, understanding the oceanography and those impacts, and then working those impacts up into the impacts on tuna is a complex thing. And we've got a good handle on what we anticipate will happen, but the exact pathway and the exact degree to which this change will happen is something that this project in particular will improve considerably.
Yeah, it's certainly a complicated topic, but a very, very important one nonetheless. Dr. Pilling, thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat and good luck with the grant and the subsequent research.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Graham Pilling, Deputy Director of the Oceanic Fisheries Program at the Pacific Community, joining us there.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your life or home isn't. Learn what to do before, during, and after disaster in a program aimed at helping you keep safe. Pacific Prepared is all things disaster preparedness for the Pacific, with a team of reporters on the ground, having conversations, and bringing you the stories that could help you, your family, and community prepare for natural disasters. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
To Papua New Guinea now, where the country's former Attorney General is calling for the reintroduction of the death penalty following the recent rape and killing of women in Port Moresby. The MP for Sinasina, Kiringa Kua, introduced a controversial death penalty law in 2012, which was repealed a decade later by Prime Minister James Marape. But Mr. Kua says rapes, willful murders and white-collar crimes are out of hand, and he sees the death penalty as a deterrent.
All the solutions that we have attempted have not worked, and that is why we are now in this space where we are ranked 133 out of 180 countries, and we are ranked second as the most violent country in the world, second. So we have to address it.
Now, the death penalty was introduced in Papua New Guinea in the early 2000s while you were Attorney General. What happened?
Back in 2012, when I first became Attorney General, I saw that the thing was slipping away. Violent crime was increasing, and corruption was increasing, white-collar crime was increasing. All of them contributed to a decay in the societal standards that we wanted, in health, education, everything else, economy. So we needed to do something to arrest. And I looked at all the options that were available, and I said, finally, I said, listen, as much as we don't like it, as much as it can feel and look very, very uncomfortable and politically incorrect, it's all about recognizing a problem and finding practical solutions to it. So that's what I suggested. And I said, I was all for increasing the scope of the use of death penalty to include, for example, stealing of substantial amounts of public funds. At the time, I nominated a figure of 10 million. Those who steal 10 million or above should be subjected to death penalty. Things like aggravated rape, use of weapons, to stage an armed robbery, willful murder, treason, and all those things should capture the death penalty. At that time, there were only three offenses that captured death penalty. I brought in an additional five that should be included. In the end, one was rejected. The one involving the theft of money was taken out because the parliament didn't want to support it. So we ended up with four, which got enacted into law. So in the end, we had seven offenses that captured that death penalty. So it was there from 2013 or thereabouts to 2021. Then in November 2021, government made the decision to repeal it under the leadership of James Marape.
And what were some of the reasons, do you think, Prime Minister Marape repealed the death penalty in 2021?
What he said was that we didn't need these things. These things are draconian measures. We should remove them. And more importantly, they said there is no evidence to show that the existence of death penalty laws in our law books have been an effective deterrent. So they repealed all the laws that prescribe for death penalty. And everybody on death row, about 13 or so prisoners on death row, were commuted to life imprisonment. Well, that was the argument. No evidence to show that it was a deterrent. Soon after the death penalty was repealed, and as soon as all the criminals in the country became aware that there was that death penalties were gone, in particular for violent crimes, there was a substantial increase of murders right across the country.
Are there instances of murders and rape occurring in other parts of Papua New Guinea?
In Porgera, there's murder every day at the Porgera mine site. In Hela, there's murder and kidnapping almost every day. And then now they're beginning to shoot and kill our policemen in Southern Highlands, in Hela, in Nenga. They're shooting at our military personnel. There is exchange of automatic gunfire, as if they're in a state of war. That's where our country is heading right now, because everybody knows that there's no deterrent. So whereas before there was no direct evidence to show whether murder has been committed, now you have direct evidence to show that when you don't have that deterrent, the death penalties, or any other serious penalty, serious crimes escalates. That's exactly what's happening now, to a point where we are ranked number two in the world as the most violent country in the world. That's my concern. I don't like this stigmatization of our country as the world's second most violent country. We got to get out of this. So we need some practical solutions. We've been debating about this for years. Nobody's, whilst on the one hand, they don't want the death penalty, did not come up with another constructive alternative. It looks like that's the only alternative effective remedy we have. That is the death penalty.
Former Attorney General of Papua New Guinea, Karenga Kua, speaking there with Caroline Tierman.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
To Tonga now, where education has always been of paramount importance to its people. The kingdom is unique in the region with its free education system for years 1 to 8, but the new government in Tonga has indicated changes are afoot and some aren't happy. The ABC's Tonga reporter Marion Kupu has been following the story and filed this report.
...66-year-old Moses Epakofe has 13 grandchildren in school. For him, Tonga's free education for years 7 and 8 has helped keep them there.
From what I have seen, it was working. Many students returned to school because of it.
And Moses is one of many parents and grandparents across the country concerned over moves by the government to put free education to an end.
They initially stated that they would continue this program, but instead they made changes that go against their promises. I do not support that decision. There are many financial obligations, and now I have to pay my grandson's school fees while he is in Form 1 at Ngeleia. As a poor man, I have to do whatever I can for the future of my children and grandchildren.
World Bank research found financial assistance for school fees was needed in Tonga, which aims to support Tonga to address secondary school dropout rates. And 15 years ago, former Minister of Education, the late Dr. Anatau Feilungaki, introduced it. The move has long had widespread support from Tonga's governments, but with the formation of Tonga's new government, things have changed. Speaking at his first prayer service with teachers and staff, new Minister of Education, Dr. Uhilamoe Langifasi, says the decision comes down to money.
The absence of school fees has resulted in a loss of over $1 million in revenue for the Ministry of Education, funds that are essential for its operations. This loss not only impacts the work that needs to be done, but also means that if the funding were to be sourced from another department, it would create a gap there.
Minister Fassi, who declined to be interviewed by the ABC for this story, stated at the prayer service that the reinstatement of school fees is needed to bring in that revenue.
There is a significant need for improvements in education, but at the same time, we must generate revenue. In the past, it was stated that school fees would not be required up to Form 5. However, I am happy to inform you that school fees will now be reinstated.
But former Minister of Education and recently ousted Tongan Prime Minister Saucy Sovaleni does not support this move. Mr. Sovaleni says education plays a critical role in the development of the kingdom.
It's basically what we were doing is based on other people's work and a long-term framework that was set up on how we develop education.
Sovaleni told the ABC that his government last year submitted to Parliament to extend free education to years 9, 10 and 11. The proposal was approved. But current Minister of Education, Dr. Fassi, claims this is a loss of revenue to the ministry. Mr. Sovaleni disagrees.
And that was already in the budget and discussed and approved by Parliament. If it is actually continued, there is no financial issue because the financial mechanism already been approved by Parliament.
According to the ministry, between year 7 to year 11, there are over 4,000 students in government schools alone. This means almost 5,000 students would have had free education this year. The government also contributes money to private schools. But the ABC understands that this has not yet been impacted. There has been passionate online discussion over the move, with many parents upset and questioning where they'll find the money. But not everyone is against it.
It is our obligation to ensure that our children receive a quality in education, and part of that quality education is the school fees.
Mafile Omasi, a mother of four, told ABC she was prepared for changes.
And I do strongly believe that it is our obligation to pay those school fees. Eh? And we've done that before. It's nothing new.
But like many families in the kingdom, Mosese and his family are now trying to figure out their cover a new big education bill. And he believes free education helps keep Tonga's children off the street.
Yes, I strongly oppose these decisions because it discourages students. Education is essential and we must invest in our children's future.
The ABC's Tonga reporter Marion Kupu with that report.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Koreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
To sport now, where three players who have served PNG cricket at the highest level for many seasons say they are determined to win their fight for better pay and conditions. They cite their primary motivation as ensuring that the young players who follow them into the senior men's team are treated with greater fairness in the future. Right now, all-rounders Norman Vanua, Charles Amini and fast bowler Nasania Pokana say they have lost all faith in cricket PNG management and are no longer prepared to play under the Barramundi's captain, Asad Vala. Amid a wave of claims and counterclaims, the three are among a larger group of senior internationals who have rejected new terms. Cricket PNG continue to insist that their offer was fair and the best one they could afford. But Pokana, Amini and Vanua see things very differently, as you'll hear during their conversation with Richard Ewart. First, here's Norman Vanua with his thoughts on what it will take to fix a dispute that has been rolling on for several months now.
To fix this, I think, honestly, it's just the right people in the right places, I'd say, making sure that, you know, things are run honestly and that the players' welfare is looked after and we're treated as the main asset of the organisation.
Do you think, therefore, that this problem cannot be solved under the current board and with the current CEO in place?
We can see it many ways, but if you want new direction, you've got to find the right people to do it. You can't have the same people doing the same thing over and over again and expect a new result.
So, Charles, if I can bring you in at this point, clearly you, like Norman, have been a member of this team for a long time now. Is this, in essence, something that's been bubbling under for years under different administrations and has come to a head now? Or is there something about this current administration which has triggered this?
Yeah, I think it's been ongoing for quite some time. And I think with the help of World Cricket Association, we've figured out that revenue that's been generated, we should be earning more than what we're receiving now. When we found that out, we knew that we could have been earning more, especially when we had received ODI status and the amount of funding that was coming into Cricket PNG. Our contracts had never changed. And speaking to other associate members and their players, what they were receiving is almost four times what we're receiving.
My understanding is that when Papua New Guinea lost their one-day international status, that meant a significant amount of money was lost to Cricket PNG, and yet the CEO has told me that they still gave you a pay rise. Do you acknowledge that?
That pay rise was really nothing. I think it was like just 50 kina added onto it. That's like $15 or $20. I don't think that's a pay rise.
Nasana, if I can bring you in at this point, I'm wondering about the relationship within the group now, because I think it's well established that there is something of a rift between certainly the three of you and I think another half a dozen players and the captain, Asad Vala.
First and foremost, when all this started, every single player of the team was on board. And then after New Year's, then we started having players going over to the other side, meaning going to cricket teams and signing the contracts. I just think that so certain people have put certain things into the players' minds and actually persuaded them to go back into signing contracts. And this is not me talking down on the other players, but they've actually changed the narrative that cricket is the only way to bring in income for a player. There's people persuading players to go back, sign the contracts, and then someone goes and tells him, hey, how are you going to feed your family? Hence, going back into signing contracts.
Norman, if I can bring you back in, would I be right in saying that neither you, nor Nasana, nor Charles could see yourselves playing under Asad as captain again? Do I have that right? Is the rift that bad?
We, the players, had the highest respect for Asad, the longest serving Barramundi throughout Cricket PNG's history. And for him to not stand up for the players, and this is not just now, this is over the years where we needed our captain to stand up on behalf of the players to voice our queries to Cricket PNG. Because if someone like Asad spoke out Cricket PNG, they would listen because he's Asad Vala. Everyone in PNG knows who Asad Vala is. But the fact that he's not had a hand in trying to make things right is just very disappointing. And for him to persuade the younger players to sign in contracts and just easily giving in to Cricket PNG is something the boys that have not signed have seen in a way where we just can't see ourselves playing a team anymore.
And Charles, have you had an opportunity to speak to Asad as somebody who clearly you know so well, you played with him for so many years? And if you've spoken to him, what has he said? What is his justification for, as Norman puts it, not standing up for the team?
No, I haven't spoken to him. And I think we've also given him enough time to, let's say, show some accountability. he's basically lost the trust and respect for us players, the ones that haven't signed. When Nosaina said that we had everyone on board before the new year, I think they were all mentioning the same thing about how disappointed they were in him. He hasn't messaged or tried to get in touch with me, or there's been no contact ever since we started the petition.
At this point, what the CEO has said is that the board have withdrawn the contracts that currently you're refusing to sign for now, but your names, the three of you and the others who haven't signed, will go into the mix for potential selection for Barramundi representation later in the year. So, Nosaina, do you expect to be selected to play for Papua New Guinea again, or do you think this could be the end of your international career?
To be honest with you, I don't think I see myself playing for PNG again. I feel that there's already bad blood within the organization. And mind you, we've come out to the media stating certain things that, you know, probably I see that can have an effect on my selection in the future.
And Norman, you've been around a long time playing for Papua New Guinea now, but do you think that your international career could be over?
According to history with Cricket PNG, once that blood's drawn, everything goes south and you're just neglected in a sense. And I've experienced this in past experiences. And once a whistleblower, you'll always be a whistleblower. And the vibes within you and the organization aren't the same anymore. You're seen as someone who's a threat rather than someone who can help PNG expand and grow as a cricketing nation and making another World Cup.
Last point to you, Charles. When all is said and done, what is going on here? It's not going to do cricket in Papua New Guinea any good. And yet the three of you have worked so hard for so many years to raise the standards, to go to World Cups, to put PNG on the map. This must be incredibly difficult, dare I say, heartbreaking for you to look at the situation that you're in. But clearly you feel so strongly about it, you're prepared to stand tall.
Yeah, I think the players need a voice, and I think we've done that pretty well. We've shown a lot of courage, especially the boys on our side. It is disappointing. We always want what's best for the players, because the players should be number one priority for any sporting organization. That is the main thing that happens all around the world. I don't think it happens really well in cricket PNG. Players should be number one priority because they bring in the sponsors, they bring in the money for the organization, they bring in everything. And you see and read a lot of comments on Facebook, and the general public, they're all supporting all the players. They're all with us. Cricket is one of the sports that they're all proud of. They love hearing good news about the Barramundis, and that's what we're fighting for, the future Barramundis. Because if we're not going to voice our struggles now, then who is going to do it? We just want what's right for the players in the future, because I'm pretty sure that if nothing gets done, the same cycle is going to continue again and again and again.
Charles Amini and his international teammates Norman Vanua, Nosaina Pokana on their collective battle for better paying conditions, and it goes on. And the three Barramundis were talking to Richard Hewitt. Well, the Pacific Oz Netball Tournament is on in Brisbane this week, and one Pacific powerhouse has been knocked out of the competition. This year's competition include Pacific teams, the Fiji Pearls, Papua New Guinea Pepes, Samoa Tifamoana, and the reigning four-time series champions, the Tonga Tala. But it's Samoa who have caught everyone by surprise and are now on course for the final after finishing fourth last year. The Pacific teams are joined by the Australian First Nations Black Swans, as well as the Scottish Thistles. Four-time defending champions Tonga Tala are now out of contention after losing to Scotland last night, their third defeat of the week. It's been hard going for Fiji and PNG, with both sides winless until last night when the Pepes beat the Pearls. Lucy Cooper filed this story.
As the Pacific Oz tournament kicked off this week, all eyes were on Tonga Tala, who were the favourites seeking their fifth title in a row. But as head coach Jacques Porimakia Simpson found, the tournament has not gone to plan.
We've probably taken the road less travelled, and we've never been in a situation before where it's going to be based on results of other matches, because we got off to a pretty rocky start at the beginning of the week. We're a little bit rusty and have only just kind of hit our stride now. So it's whether we've left that run too late or whether we've done enough to get there that day.
The last time Tonga Tala played together was June last year, a factor coach Markia Simpson said has played into their shaky start, but hopes their unique style will lead to the outcomes they want.
There's no doubt that our players have a lot of X factor, and that can be a difficult thing to coach. It can be a difficult thing to play against. But the one thing that is probably their biggest strength is their ability to know what their purpose is and having that drive them.
On the flip side, Samoa, who came out on top against reigning champs Tonga, are now eyeing off the final. Player Christiana Manua is proud of how the team has progressed.
I can't say that we've had much of a build-up because we only just got together for the first time as a full squad on Monday. But despite of that, I feel like we've come together really strong. We have a long way to go as a franchise and as a national team to be a bit more professional, but then it's also exciting because, like, look at the team we've put together in such short notice with, like, not much kind of trials or anything, and to be able to perform the way we are, it's really exciting.
Christiana is playing for Samoa on Australian soil for the first time.
I've played for Australia, I played for New Zealand, but I think playing for Samoa in my nation, it's almost, like, kind of fulfilled me and kind of filled that part of me that was a bit missing, and I think it comes from representing my family and, you know, their migration story, and it's the same for all the girls.
She welcomes a healthy rivalry with Tonga.
I love it. I think it's so good for our sport, so good for our nations. And when we're out on that netball court, it's going to be bigger than Tuesday. And I hope we see them again in the finals so we can show just what we're made of.
But the tournament, with the games still to come tonight and the final tomorrow, is far from over.
Yeah, I don't think Tonga's going to take their foot off the accelerator. We want to win clean sweep. That's just our goal. We do want to, you know, obviously try and maintain bodies and make sure we're looking after ourselves, but our goal is definitely to clean sweep this competition.
Natalie Matthews, Samoa's head coach, said the tournament couldn't be going better.
I think it was maybe the third or fourth quarter against Tonga, and I looked up, had a moment, took a breath, and thought, this is actually happening. So it's been everything I expected it to be and everything I wanted it to be.
She said she isn't surprised her team beat Tonga.
I had a dream about what I wanted to do with this team. That's coming to fruition, I think, in terms of the connection between myself and the players, and I think that's transmitting onto court.
Samoa, Papua New Guinea and Fiji have in the past year overhauled their coaching and management staff, a move that is paying off for Natalie Matthews' team.
What we've created in camp is definitely different to what Netball Samoa have seen before, and I think that's doing its part for the players to be able to perform at their best. I knew that Tonga was going to be big competition coming into this, as did everybody. I think because of the reputation that Samoa might have had previously, people didn't see us as competitive as we have been.
Lua Rickus ending that report from Lucy Cooper, and a quick correction on the intro there. It was the Pearls that beat the Pepes to score their first win of the tournament. And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat. We'll be back at the same time Monday morning. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. Then Nisha Daily. My name's Kyle Evans. Have a fantastic day.